Welcome to the Black Sparrow Media Internet Broadcast Network.
You are listening to Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a podcast about Linux, open source, and amateur radio, for everyone. Now here are your hosts, Cheryl, W5MOO, Russ, K5TUX, and Bill, NE4RD.
Well, hello everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 542 of Linux in the Ham Shack. This is The Weekender. It is the 116th edition of The Weekender here in sort of the beginning of quarter two, 2024, just a mere 2.5 weeks from Hamvention. Thank you for joining us for this Weekender edition, and we certainly look forward to seeing everybody out in Ohio coming up really, really soon now. We're going to do the Weekender tonight. We're going to get into a random topic that's going to be chosen for us shortly, and then we're going to dive headlong into hedonism and talk about all the stuff that makes life worth living. But before we do that, we'll introduce ourselves for the on assignment yet again. Cheryl, W5MOO. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD.
Somewhere hunkered down, yes, in a hotel room in D.C., I guess.
Yes, in the business center inside of a hotel here in Roslyn, Virginia.
Roslyn, Virginia. All right. Never even heard of that place, but yeah, whatever.
If you've been to D.C., you should probably know Roslyn.
I have been to D.C.
So. Yeah, we're just on the south, south side, whatever, on the other side of the Potomac from Georgetown. If you take the red line or whatever, not the red line, I guess the blue, orange, purple, green, you know, all those lines that go from the metro center south, we're like virtually the next stop past Foggy Bottom. So,
I know Foggy Bottom. I stayed in a hotel in Georgetown that was like, I don't know, 3 or 4 blocks from there or something. So
yeah. So, we're just the next metro stop, across the Potomac, basically. So you go under the river and that's the very first stop is Roslyn, which is right next to the Arlington National Cemetery.
Okay. Yeah. I know that area for sure. Just didn't know it as Roslyn. Cause I remember going to Foggy Bottom and all that area in there, for a conference back in, '07. So that was a while back. Oh, no. That was '06. Yeah, 7 was where I almost died in Dallas. not from any accident.
Gunshots. No grassy knolls or anything.
No. I was just incredibly sick. I literally got to the conference. Cheryl had to drive. I was so sick, and I stayed in bed for 4 days of the conference. So
you've done this at Hamvention too, right?
Well, I did get the sick the one time there at Hamvention. Yeah, that was not cool. But that was only a day. All right. So anyway, we should probably get on, little doggy, and see what our topic for tonight is going to be. So I believe our picker wheel is making noises tonight. So I'm going to go hit the button and see what we get. So glad I don't have to put that into post. Yeah, makes my life a lot easier. But anyway, this is one that you'll probably have to address a little bit more than me because I haven't really done it that well or that much. It's practical antennas for top band operating.
Practical antennas for top band operating.
You know more antennas than I do, and because I've only used a couple of different antennas, and I only operate top band if I can get my tuner to basically make a wet noodle resonant. So what kind of I think the one that most people use isn't the inverted L's or the random wires with the 9-to-1 ununs and that kind of thing. Isn't that what everybody uses for top band so they don't have to have, you know, 80 meters of wire laid out.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're space compromised, those are definitely alternatives that you can use. There are obviously Cushcraft / MFJ makes a vertical, the MA-160 or something like that. That is basically an extremely shortened vertical. Those would probably work. And I'm air quoting work because everything here, unless you're using full length wire and a lot of height, they all sort of work in a way that you can get on the air. I mean, I've done the 9 to 1 with 63 foot of wire, so the shorter version. And I worked the 160 contest, and it was fine. I mean, it could have been better. There was definitely stations that I heard that they could not hear me. So it's one of those things that, when you're on top band, it does become a smidge harder to even work the ones that you can hear. So, for practical antennas, I mean, they do work. You can definitely get on there. I've been on FT8 on 160 on the NFID half wave. I would probably recommend getting if you're going to do that antenna because of limited space, if you can squeeze the other length, I think it's 123 foot length for your random wire length for that 9 to 1, I think that one performs even better on 160. I don't have any experience with it, but I mean, math, the numbers look better, for tunability and everything else. I also have the Voyager DX sitting in the garage, which works on 160, has a big capacitance hat for a multi-band vertical, runs 20 through 160. I have not used that, but if you happen to have one in your garage like I do, that would be very practical.
Well, okay, let me put a little caveat on the word practical in this case. Because like there's some suggestions in the chat room as well, like directional Yagis and Rommic antennas, and yeah, you Rommic. Of course have a Voyager. Yeah, well, see, the thing is, practical, I kind of feel like when you're looking at Rommics and Voyagers, you're talking about $600-$700, maybe, you know, $100 antennas, maybe even more, especially when you're getting into the Rommics. I don't know how practical that is for some people.
Well, I mean,
if you're buying an antenna that costs more than your rig, I don't consider that practical necessarily.
Well, I mean, if you look at most multiband verticals, they do cost more than most people would want to shell out for a rig, or at least half the price of a modern HF rig. The doublet Mike is using works really well. That's again a multiband, you know, what off center fed basically, dealy merbobber. Technically, you can tune. Technically, if you have a tuner that can tune stuff, you can squeeze some signal actually out on the band. Obviously, the tuner is going to eat a lot of it. That's sort of the way it works with some of these longer antennas that are short fed or have additional coils or, you know, whatever miracle application that you have applied to in order for the antenna to look longer electrically than what it physically is. I mean, those are always going to be high compromise antennas, but this is just for practicality. And I think you for the cheapest bang for the buck, I think you could definitely throw up an NFID half wave with a 9 to 1, 63 foot. It works. It will tune. I think it starts at about I think it's like 1.82 to 1 or something like that in one spot of the band. So, I mean, you can tune around and kind of get it tweaked a little bit. You could snip a little bit of the wire. And you can make your own balun in that case, too. So I think that's pretty cheap. Dan's mentioning the Cobra antenna, which is an 80 meter long antenna that will tune on 160. So if that's what true 80 meters long, then it's 120 some odd feet too, as well, something like that. 66 foot on each side. Let's see. Dan's typing. Yeah, something like that. There you go.
Right, at that sort of magic 123 number.
Exactly. It gets you that same kind of number, that 120 foot range plus or minus. I mean, if you could squeeze that distance, I think there's lots of practical antennas that you could possibly use. And what kind of signal comes out on them really depends upon at that point how high you got it up, the configuration of where the feed point is. A lot of people will use the multi-band inverted Ls, where they'll get as much of the antenna before it's trapped off for 160 vertical, and then just run the 160 leg out horizontally. Those work really well. There's many, many free designs out there that you can do to make it yourself, including all of the traps. So you can, yeah, I mean, it's very practical. I still think the 9-to-1 is like the most practical, just because it's an all compromise antenna. You know, you've given every compromise because you went to extremities to be lazy and just deploy wire and then a tiny little box that has your 9-to-1 in it.
Yeah, and I think if I remember correctly, the rule of thumb is that generally speaking, if you're trying to operate an antenna that, like, for most effective radiation, you want the antenna to be at least half of the band's wavelength above the ground. But these will sort of, they won't compensate right for it, but you can make them work and make them tune, even though you're sort of compromising in a lot of ways, because these antennas are, you know, ridiculously large. So you have to do something to make them electrically longer, basically. And of course, that's always a compromise.
Well, I mean, think about it. If you just want to use that rule of a half wavelength above the ground or whatever, I mean, what's a half wavelength on 160? Like 200 some odd foot?
Yeah.
You know, the length of a dipole is a half wavelength. So, yeah, that's impractical. You'll never do that. So, like, the key with a good deployment for 160 is to have a majority of the antenna to be vertical, at least all of the parts that are considered the electrical parts. That's why you see a lot of the interesting shortened designs having very large capacitance hats and stuff like that. So you can bleed off a lot of that extra energy and also electrically shorten the antenna. But you know, I think anything with a capacitance hat is probably not terribly practical unless you already have something. I mean, there are designs that are in the books that you can find online, and as well, I think there's plenty of downloadable designs to do that. But practicality, you know, inverted L is, I think, the number one thing that you could put up and get most of your electrical length to be vertical. So at least you get a decent takeoff angle. The problem, if you have a perfectly flat antenna on the ground, you have what most people would consider an NVIS situation, where you have the near vertical incidence signal. So, like, you know, most of your signal is just basically just going to go straight up and come straight back down. So you're basically creating a cloud warmer for your neighborhood. It would still work, though. Like, I had a perfectly horizontal antenna that was probably 30 foot off the ground, the NFIT half wave. And I mean, it worked. I worked across the country, coast to coast. I did not work any DX. I've never worked any DX on that antenna, but I have worked stations that have the capability and have the right equipment on their end to A, hear me, and B, transmit a signal back to me. So it is completely possible that even a truly fully compromised antenna will still provide some results. You're not going to have probably a rag chew worthy antenna where you can get up on a net or something like that on 160 and have people respond to you. But in the midst of a contest or QSO party or something like that, I think you'd have a good chance using a highly compromised, very or extremely practical antenna on top band and feel like you've had some success.
Yeah. Very good. That's more than I knew about it. All I know is that if you're going to be doing something like putting up a top band antenna with like an inverted L configuration, you might want to avail yourself of a bow and arrow or a spud gun or a heavy weight, because you're going to have to try and get the vertical part of the antenna as high up as you can, which usually means somehow slinging it over a tree. I think that's how most people deploy them. And of course, all of this is predicated on the fact that you have some place to actually put these lengths of wire and trees. I don't know. I mean, you're going to have to go into some of these high capacitance hat antennas, small for like small form factor designs like the Rhombix and things like that. But when you're, unless you're, you know, digging into the antenna book or some other resource, and building these things yourself, if you're acquiring them commercially, they're all going to be very much on the pricey side. So that's where you kind of want to look into becoming a kit builder and a true ham and making your own equipment.
Yeah, I mean, you know, now that you say it too, I mean, there is also the idea, if you're in open space, so let's say, you know, like field day conditions where you're out in the country and you decided that you will not be like good old Dan there and do PR work for your field day operation and decide to just totally take it off the grid. I have heard and seen people use helium balloons to lift their vertical radiators on 160 to have a 160 vertical with wire. I have also seen, you know, vertical element raised with a large delta kite as well. So, I mean, if you wanted to be slightly extreme in your practicality, and this is not, you know, something that you'd have at your house, but like something for a special event or something like that, there is totally a possibility that you can put 500, you know, I mean, you know, what do you need for a vertical? 120 some odd feet in the air, maybe a little bit more. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, you could do it with, you know, a nice party balloons and everything else. If you'd actually have a recoverable balloon, which would probably make some of the environmental people happy that you aren't killing turtles with your high altitude balloons, because you'd be able to recover it back with your copper wire in the sky. But totally possible with a balloon or a large delta kite in the right conditions, and of course, you know, well away from power lines and stuff like that.
Yeah, and if you were to use what, three lines, you could actually keep it stationary as well. If you were.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you wouldn't want a stunt kite up there or something.
I was thinking more for the balloons than the kites, but
yeah, the balloons, you could definitely anchor it down and have it tied off in multiple places. So
yeah, that's an interesting idea. Never really thought about that. Of course, I don't even think there's anywhere on this property where I could find 123 continuous feet of wire of any kind. So unless it was barbed wire, I guess that.
Ooh,
I
mean, no. No. Don't do it. Fine if yeah. You want to use it for receive, but don't use it for anything else. The velocity of the steel wire is just wrong. It doesn't play nicely.
Yeah, I had no intention of stringing 123 feet of barbed wire to a balloon anyway. So that's not happening. But anyway, Joel also mentioned using a drone to drop wire over a tree, which I guess you could do that, but if you're into buying drones and going through all the process of having FCC licensing and all of that stuff, you're probably in the range where you could just buy a rhombic or something else. So,
well, I mean, a rhombic you got to keep up in the air. So if you're gonna do like a rhombic on 160, that thing has to be mounted about 100 foot in the air, and it would not be practical at all.
Yeah. So are there other designs like the quads and, you know, Yagis and stuff like that that are practical to keep an antenna for 160 like shorter and lower?
Well, I mean, you could do a loop of some sort or a delta loop that's horizontal. You'd still want to try to get it up as high as possible, so it will suffer from some invis handling when it's close to the ground. I don't think you could build a vertically oriented 160 quad or a delta loop because it would just be, you know, infinitesimally high. I mean, it's, yeah, that thing would be like, yeah, it went 80 foot aside or something like that. So would not be practical unless you had some, you know, you're living in the you know, the redwood forest or something like that, and can, you know, string up your ends of your wire 100 foot in the air or something crazy.
Or just go plug into the harp array.
Well, I don't know. I don't know how that works, but those are all dishes, so it's a little different.
All right. Well, I think that's some interesting and good information. And, of course, there are lots of books like the ARRL's antenna book and stuff like that on operating properly with different kinds of antennas, guides on how to build lots of different kinds of antennas. And, of course, there are the commercial options, which, you know, you can always go out and buy an antenna for the purpose that you are looking to use it for. So,
I mean, there's I just have to say, like, I mean, you can always just experiment with stuff. I had a friend at one time that built a 17 meter Sturba curtain and fed it with 500 foot of 450 ohm ladder line. And he played on every band with it. So on 160, you were pretty much using the ladder line as the antenna, and the Sturba curtain was basically the capacitance hat for it. But in theory, it worked. It's very odd, but like, you sometimes can think more extremely out of the box and just try it. Because again, you're talking about practicality and usability, and you know, it might not work. I mean, that's because it's practical doesn't mean it's acceptable.
Yeah, they're getting crazy now. Now we're talking about hooking onto your local AM station and stuff like that, because those actually operate just outside of the 160 meter band. So, well, actually, yeah, lower, just below it.
Yeah, and they normally have three towers running those. So, like, those are like, I'm not sure how, I think those are shunt fed towers or something like that. But, yeah, I mean, you could shunt fed your tower, too, if you happen to have, you know, a nice big tall boy there sitting there like 120 foot in the air. That would work. But that's only practical if you have a monster tower in your backyard.
Yeah, and once you're getting up into monster tower category, I think it's, what, 200 feet, then now you're into FAA territory and you've got other problems to deal with. So,
Oh, yeah. You want to stay below 200 feet no matter what.
So, all right, very good. I think that was a nice discussion about that. Spirited in all the craziness, and I'm sure there'll be more talk about crazy antennas as the night goes on. But we can whet some of those discussions with some food and booze, so we should probably move on to that. So let's get into some hedonism. Cheryl is, of course, not here, so that means she has left us a drink and a recipe for food that I'm going to have to go through here. So she has left us for food a skillet chicken bulgogi, which sounds very Korean, probably because it is. This bulgogi chicken is a quick and easy but very tasty meal. You can substitute the chicken with beef or pork for variety. It only takes 30 minutes with very few dirty dishes, and you can serve it over rice, either white rice, brown rice, or fried rice. All very good. And you can make this stuff hot or not, as you choose. And we kind of make it hot, because it's really good hot. So you can make it using chopped onions, soy sauce, brown sugar, minced garlic, sesame oil, sesame seeds, cayenne pepper, and salt and ground black pepper to taste. Actually, this is not the thing I thought it was. That's the Korean barbecue. So this is a different thing. So this isn't quite as hot. But basically, you just have to whisk all of the wet and dry ingredients together in a bowl until it's smooth to create a marinade. Marinate everything together and then cook it. So there you go. You can also use different kind of oils if you want a different flavor out of it, or if you are conscientious and want to use like avocado oil or peanut oil or something other than that disgusting animal fat or whatever it is. But you can pretty much make it however you want, and directions on all of that will, of course, be in the show notes. And for her mixed drink corner, she left us a key lime mojito. If you have an abundance of key limes after making a classic key lime pie, or if you just happen to go out and buy some key limes, use some up to make this refreshing summer cocktail. The tart juice of key limes make the mojito a bit sharper and more citrusy, and the cream makes it taste like a creamy slice of key lime pie. And who doesn't like a good key lime pie? You'll need a simple syrup for this cocktail, which is super easy to make if you don't want to buy one, and they're also pretty cheap to buy. You can even add some mint to make it minty. The ingredients are crushed graham cracker, simple syrup, fresh mint leaves, key lime juice, white rum, heavy cream, and key lime rounds for a garnish. And the rest of that information will be in the show notes if you want to make yourself some key lime mojitos. And I'm going to let Bill cover his whatever corner first before I go into mine, just so I can stop talking for a second.
Very well. Yeah, I was actually going to do a beer from Boulevard Brewing down by you, but I'm not at home, so I don't have any here. So I will do what the bar had downstairs here at the hotel, which I just happened to have, you know, maybe one or two before this, so I could, remind myself the flavors that were there. But this is Hoptimization by Brothers Craft Brewing. They're out of Harrisonburg, Virginia. And, I would never have heard of this before. And they say, at least on Untappd, here's their comment, "What's a craft brewery to do when all the typical IPA hops are gone?" And Russ would say, "Throw them away." throw them away. innovate. Yeah. Innovate, of course, just like craft breweries always have. Hoptimization uses big, bold, bitter hops to get a clean, citrusy flavor you'll love and the bitter bite that you crave. Step away from a typical and try something new. So this is a 7.1 ABV beer and is 71 IBUs. So this definitely is pretty high on the bitterness unit scale. And I'd still say it's pretty approachable. It's a pretty smooth drinking beer. I do think it has a little bit more of a bite than I particularly like when I'm having an IPA. I'm more of I like the fruity and juicy, hazy IPAs. This is not a hazy IPA. This is fairly clear. It has a darker amber color. So it's on the darker side of the yellows that we're used to seeing with the IPAs. So that nice coppery color. And, it's a pretty nice beer, actually. It doesn't have a lot of aftertaste, so you don't have anything lingering after you've had one or two or three or four or 20, you know. but it's pretty tasty. I mean, I would consider having it again. I would trying to think what popular beer would I say it tastes most like, and I can't really come up with one that would possibly be insulting. So, because I just don't think anything really fits your profile. That's the thing with IPAs. They're so varied that there's only like a few that come close to just like clipping the same palates and stuff like that. But it's a very nice, it's a very nice beer. And let me see if there was there a note here. Okay. No beer notes in the chat room. So, so we'll leave it at that. That's a pretty good beer. It's available here at the bar. So that's what I went with. What do you got?
All right. Well, as the people who are here in the chat room know, I was talking about this just before the show started, but I am going to be reviewing a single malt scotch called Cardis, which is an expression made by Laphroaig. For anybody who's heard the name Laphroaig before, you'll know that it's a very peaty and iodiney Islay scotch. So for those people who are not into that kind of flavor profile, feel free to tune out now. But if that is definitely something you like, you should definitely keep your ears peeled for this one, because I'm going to say a couple of things about this at the end that may be moderately shocking. First, let me read what they say about themselves. This is from the Laphroaig website. Bottled at a fixed strength of 52.3%, Laphroaig Cardis 2023 is aged in white port and Madeira casks, created exclusively for Friends of Laphroaig. Our Cardis expression... That doesn't mean you can't get it. You can get it. You just have to go buy it. Our Cardis expression for 2023 brings together the best of much-loved Cardis releases over recent years. The limited edition single malt is a combination of Madeira and white port casks. Three-quarters of the whiskey is matured in second-fill Madeira casks, releasing smoky, spicy, and sweet fruit flavors. The final quarter has been finished in a first-fill port cask. The majority of these are white port, adding a hint of crisp fruit and deep woodiness to the flavor. It's a new take on Laphroaig that plays to our strengths, welcoming old friends and new. So since it's a single malt scotch, it's 100% malted barley. It does come from the Islay region of Scotland and the Laphroaig distillery out there in the northern islands of Scotland. The color is a soft burnished gold, because all of those scotches, even though they mature for potentially a very long time, they don't really infiltrate the wood as much, so their colors are generally lighter than bourbons or American whiskeys. So the nose on this is really, really nice. Now, interestingly, this is finished in two different wine casks, and the wine definitely has influence on the flavors of the whiskey, but it does not influence it in a way that makes it taste like wine, which I find fascinating, intriguing, and the flavors are just really wonderful. So on the nose, you get cinnamon, fresh ground ginger, green apple with notes of toasted peach, charred orange peel, caramelized sugar, and of course that famous Lafroy smoke. On the taste, you get honey paired with juicy citrus flavors, different kinds back and forth, usually wandering between lemon, orange, and some non-citrusy stuff like mango or peach. You get notes of hazelnut, tannic oak notes, dark chocolate, bitter caramel, and an iodine-rich smoke. Absolutely. The wine tempers all of this a little bit and melds it and just kind of makes it all go together really, really nicely. On the finish, it's sweet and smooth with lingering earthy peat notes, creosote phenolic character, a bit sea salty, and of course, all of those fruit and, you know, apple and ginger and kind of leather and cinnamon, all that stuff is all sort of mingled in there at the end, and it fades into a nice saltiness. So I have reviewed three other Lafroigs on this program, and they have ranged in rating from 88 to 96. They're all very good. They fit my flavor profile really well. I enjoy them a lot. The cost on this bottle, this is actually, this is actually a 70 centiliter bottle, so it's a little smaller, 700 milliliters. And if you can find it, it's not super hard to find right now. It's actually kind of out there. And this comes in at $100 a bottle. So definitely not on the cheap side for sure. But here are the two things I'm going to say about this. One, this is probably one of maybe two bottles of whiskey that I've had in my whole life that is absolutely underpriced at $100. It's really that good. And I'm going to give this a rating of 98. This is probably one of the best Scotch whiskeys I have ever had. And I will look forward to the thing that displaces this as the highest rated whiskey I've reviewed.
Interesting.
And again, this is going to be for those people who can sort of take the iodine-y, salty, smoky type scotches. If that is not your thing and you know who you are, you definitely should stay away from this. But if that is your thing, I can't think of a better one that I've had.
Wow.
Okay. Well, that's that. So we're down to kind of the end. We're getting into announcements and feedback. And we did have one post over on Mastodon from Johan, Papa Delta One, Juliet Mike Bravo, who says, please don't use AI image crap.
That's funny.
Okay, this is not particularly constructive, Johan, but I will address it for those people who may or may not have noticed. If you ever look at the episode icons on the show, you will probably have seen that I use an AI art generator to produce them. I find it really convenient for me. I can create an image that is not borrowing somebody else's image, and it can be exactly the thing that I want it to be. So I really like it. I happen to really like AI generated art. I am definitely going to continue to use it because I love it. So apologies, Johan, if it's not your thing. If you have issues with AI in general or whatever your problem is, I can only apologize for that, but I'm going to continue to use it because it's part of my workflow and I really enjoy it. So,
well, I mean, you know, Johan sounds like an artist because he has like strong emotions towards this. So maybe he's like volunteering to design all of the artwork for all of the episodes.
Well, absolutely. If I can send you a text prompt and you can generate AI, you can generate art for me for every episode, by all means, I'll go down that road with you. All right. With that, let's go ahead and get to our social media stuff here. New subscribers, supporters, and live participants. And we did have a few. No new subscribers or Patreons, but in Facebook, we had Scott Shellhart, Brian Holub, Hamdi Abuelanine, Mark Cohen, Herman Sprogels, Andy Reinhardt, and Jim Browder, and 33 other people who shall remain nameless because Facebook doesn't want us to know who you are. On Twitter, we had at Fro of Norfolk, and we had at Fawazihi, something like that. On Instagram, we have dsc.carlos.silva. On Mastodon, at Karims. Nobody joined us on the mailing list. On Discord, we had Vortac, Katie, Kiyoki, and Up in Smoke, all the same person. Fjord, and 77 Scout SS2. Nobody on YouTube. And then finally in the live chat tonight, we had Dan, KB6NU, Tony, K4XSS, Joel, KC0YEW, Jill, K1TTZ, Ted, WA0EIR, Mike, K6GTE, and Dr. Volt Iceland, who actually is in Iceland. So thanks for joining us all the way from Reykjavik tonight. And I can say that with confidence because I asked him if that's where he lived, and he said yes. So, all right. That brings us down to the end of the show. Thanks, everybody, for joining us for this Weekender edition. We hope you enjoyed it. And we definitely hope we see everybody out in Ohio in a couple and a half weeks. Boy, it's coming up really quick. We're looking forward to it. And we hope you'll also tune into the next episode, our deep dive, when it comes out. And we hope you have a great week in between. And with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up. Episode number 542. Of Linux in the Ham Shack. For the on assignment, Cheryl, W5MOO, I am Russ, K5TUX.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD73.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Linux in the Ham Shack. LHS is a community-sponsored podcast. Live recordings are Sunday nights at 8 o'clock Central Time. Our homepage can be found at lhspodcast.info. You can support the podcast via Patreon at patreon.com/lhspodcast. We're also on Discord, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Mastodon. Contact us via email at info@lhspodcast.info or via voicemail at 1-909-547-7469. That's 1-909-LHS-SHOW. We also have merch. So until next we meet, remember to always heed your hedonism.